ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 10th of April. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Australia is considering recognising Palestinian statehood as part of an international push to end the Israel-Hamas war. The Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, says international recognition could help build momentum towards a two-state solution with Israel. The government's ramped up its criticism of Israel in recent months amid the mounting civilian death toll in Gaza. It's also appointed former Australian Defence Force Chief Mark Binskin to examine Israel's investigation of the airstrikes that killed Australian Zomi Frankham and six other aid workers last week. Political reporter Evelyn Manfield is in Canberra. Evelyn, the Foreign Minister Penny Wong has given a detailed speech explaining why she thinks the two-state solution and the Australian government thinks it's the best hope for peace in the Middle East. What are her main arguments?
Well, she says that international recognition could help build momentum towards a two-state solution. And while Australia doesn't currently recognise a Palestinian state, the Australian government has said for a while now that it wants to see a two-state solution in the future where Israel and a future Palestinian state could coexist. So in this speech, the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, seems to suggest that the government is contemplating recognising Palestinian statehood. She also pointed to the UK, comments made by the British Foreign Secretary David Cameron there, who has previously said that the UK will look at the issue of recognising a Palestinian state, including at the United Nations. Now, in this speech at the Australian National University in Canberra last night, Penny Wong pointed to the thousands of lives lost in this war so far, the 1,200 Israelis who were killed in the Hamas attacks and the more than 33,000 Palestinians who have been killed in Israel's attacks since then. She says that there needs to be a pathway out of the endless cycle of violence. But she did point out as well that there would be no role for Hamas in a future Palestinian state and that there would need to be a reformed Palestinian authority. She actually said that recognising a Palestinian state would undermine Hamas. Here's part of her speech last night.
Now, there are those who always claim recognition is rewarding an enemy. This is wrong. First, because Israel's own security depends on a two-state solution. There is no long-term security for Israel unless it is recognised by the countries of its region. But the normalisation agenda that was being pursued before October 7 cannot proceed without progress on Palestinian statehood.
Evelyn, this will be controversial, especially among Australia's Jewish community. Has there been any response?
We've received a statement from the Zionist Federation of Australia. They say that any talk of recognition of Palestinian statehood in such close proximity to the October 7 attacks was entirely premature and will be seen as a reward for those attacks. They say too that before any talk of statehood is credible, Hamas must be removed and a new generation of Palestinian leadership must emerge. We've also heard from Shadow Foreign Affairs spokesperson Simon Birmingham. He says that the government's argument to preemptively recognise a Palestinian state puts statehood before security and also says that it will be seen as a win by Hamas. He says it's downright dangerous to reward the conduct of Hamas on October 7 with a fast track to recognition of statehood, also saying that Labor is threatening to break decades of bipartisan Australian foreign policy.
Evelyn Manfield there. The Israel Defence Force spokesman admits there's been a terrible failure in targeting an aid convoy in Gaza last week, which killed aid worker Zomi Frankham and six other humanitarian workers. In the initial aftermath, Israel said a convoy of World Central Kitchen vehicles was targeted with drone strikes because they mistakenly thought Hamas gunmen were inside the cars. The Israeli Defence Force says it doesn't know if it or the government will hand over evidence to Australia's investigator Mark Binskin. The former Australian Chief of Defence was appointed earlier this week to examine what happened and whether Australia should push for further investigation, including possible war crimes. Israeli Defence Force spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner is speaking here with our Middle East correspondent Alison Horn.
Is there any evidence that there were Hamas gunmen inside any of those vehicles at any point?
Not that I'm aware of.
So how was a conclusion made that these vehicles could have Hamas gunmen in them?
I can appreciate the difficulty in understanding what transpired. We have a terrorist organization that uses these type of vehicles to mobilize within the Gaza Strip. He made the fire support officer made a wrong connection between the gunman and these vehicles, and not knowing that these vehicles are WCK, created that connection. He didn't confirm it. The intelligence was not intelligence beyond the visual intelligence, which was a misinterpretation of what he was seeing. This is the individual failures, the organizational failures, the coordination failures.
So they targeted the vehicle with no evidence.
We're in a war. That's a pretty clear question.
It's a developing
situation. If you're asking, did they know that there were Hamas gunmen? No, they didn't. That is the reality, and that is why they have been severely dealt with in the case of this failure.
Lieutenant, international law requires an attacker to take all feasible precautions to verify that a target is military and not civilians. Do you admit the IDF didn't do that in this case?
I admit that we failed terribly in this case at protecting the workers of the WCK.
Australia says it's not satisfied with your explanation and investigation. It's appointed Mark Binskin, who is a former senior military officer in Australia, to conduct an investigation. Will you be cooperating with that investigation?
I don't know. I think that is the question that needs to be referred through the government, from government to government. I don't know if that's happened, so I think we need to check that with the foreign ministry.
If Australia requests all the documentation that you say you have, including video evidence, surveillance, communications, testimonies from IDF on the ground, will you provide that to Australia?
I think that that's a question, again, for the government to government. The IDF is an official body of the government implementation of the government policies. The government will determine its policy and the IDF will operate accordingly.
It's Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner ending that interview with Alison Horn in Tel Aviv. And AM has contacted the Israeli Foreign Ministry about whether it will provide Australia with full access to any investigation, and we were referred back to the IDF spokesman. The federal government is unveiling a major overhaul of business merger laws today with the aim of speeding up and streamlining the process for low-risk deals. But it wants more transparency in the process, boosting the power of the competition watchdog, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, to examine planned big takeovers to ensure monopolies don't result, or even to analyse companies that swallow up smaller businesses over a period of time which thwart competition and consumers lose out. The new laws won't be in place until 2026. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, joined me earlier. Jim Chalmers, before we get to the new merger laws, could I ask about the question of Palestine? The federal government says it's considering recognising Palestine as a way of building support for a two-state solution. The opposition says that recognition rewards Hamas for the October the 7th attacks. Is that the danger here?
No, I don't think so, Sabra. And I was there at the Australian National University for Penny Wong's characteristically considered and thoughtful contribution. And she made a number of points, but among them was the point that if we want to build a pathway out of this endless cycle of violence and bloodshed, then a two-state solution offers us the best chance. And that's why the international community, including our friends around the world, are considering whether recognition builds momentum towards that two-state solution and the peaceful future that we want for people on both sides of that horrendous conflict.
You see this is the only way of stopping that war?
Well, we see it as an important way forward. And unfortunately, progress towards a two-state solution has stalled. And in recent times, we've seen the consequences of the Hamas terrorist organisation running that part of the world. And one of the arguments that Penny made was that a two-state solution offers the best chance for stability in that part of the world, but also for that peaceful future that we want to see for everyone.
To the proposed new merger laws, why does this matter for everyday Australians? How will these merger takeover laws improve their lives?
Well, a more competitive economy means more choices for people at fairer prices. And our economy is not competitive enough as it stands, and it's been getting less competitive over recent decades, and that comes at a cost to everyone, and we want to address that because a more competitive economy is better for consumers, it's better for businesses, and it's better for the economy more broadly. And mergers reform is a big part of that, of making our economy more competitive. And that's why we're embarking today on the biggest changes to the mergers regime in something like 50 years.
The government is proposing more power for the consumer watchdog, the ACCC. It will have 30 days to approve or reject most mergers. There'll be time for complex takeovers. Companies will have to be explicit and tell people about their merger plans. Now, that doesn't always happen. What will be the number one consideration in accepting or rejecting these planned takeovers?
Yeah, well, the first thing to recognise is that the current system is too hit and miss. It's voluntary. There are multiple streams that people can choose from. We don't actually know if the right mergers are being scrutinised. And so we are going to fix that. And that's because we want good mergers to proceed more quickly, but we want concerning mergers to receive a bit more robust scrutiny. And so in terms of your question specifically, what this means is if a potential merger raises competition concerns, the ACCC can apply a test of whether it substantially lessens competition, but also whether it expands and entrenches more market power in the market. You know, most mergers are good. Most mergers are about scale. Most mergers have obvious economic benefits, but there are some which are concerning, where they expand and entrench market power or where they substantially lessen competition. And what these reforms will mean, they'll mean the regime is faster and simpler, more targeted, more transparent and stronger. But it means that good mergers can proceed quicker and concerning mergers receive a bit more robust scrutiny.
You were working for Treasurer Wayne Swan as an advisor when he allowed Westpac to take over St George. In hindsight, was that wise? Would a fifth major bank perhaps have stopped the bad behaviour that followed in the remaining decade?
Well, I think that's a bit of a stretch, Sabra, but I'm reluctant to comment on or second-guess decisions taken by former treasurers, whether it's Wayne or otherwise. What this is about is getting the merger regime right into the future. There has been scrutiny of bank mergers in the past and currently, but what we want to do here with these really important reforms is to make sure that where mergers are fine, whether they're below a threshold or they don't raise any competition concerns, they can proceed. And for those that do raise those concerns, then they get robustly scrutinised. This is a really important way. By fixing the mergers regime, we make our economy more competitive. If it's more competitive, it's more dynamic and it's more productive and it's better for consumers and businesses alike.
As you've alluded to, another major bank merger is sitting on your desk right now. ANZ wants to take over Queensland Suncorp Bank. How happy do you think your fellow Queenslanders would be to see that brand disappear at a time when the Big Four are still trying to repair their reputations?
Yeah, again, I mean, there are a range of considerations that I need to apply to that. That's been through a couple of processes now. That one has been robustly scrutinised in some detail by the ACCC and then by the relevant tribunal. And so I will take the necessary time to go through the arguments put in relation to that. And there are a number of considerations that I need to apply, and it wouldn't be appropriate for me to preempt them today on your show.
Jim Chalmers, thanks for talking to AM.
Much appreciated, Sabra. Have a great day.
Jim Chalmers is the Federal Treasurer. Climate change activists around the world are celebrating a landmark victory at the European Court of Human Rights. The case was brought by thousands of older Swiss women. Lawyers say it could set a global precedent. Europe correspondent Isabella Higgins reports.
Outside the European Court of Human Rights, celebration and applause. A group of Swiss women hug and cheer as they mark their legal victory. This is the first time the powerful court has made a ruling on global warming. Anne Murray was among the group of more than 2,000 women aged over 64 who brought this case forward.
We can be very proud. We, the elderly, have brought to the court for the first time the issue of climate and fundamental rights, and the court has recognised us and our fundamental right to a healthy climate.
The women claimed their age and gender made them particularly vulnerable to the effects of heatwaves linked to climate change. On Tuesday, the court ruled that the Swiss government had violated the human rights of its citizens by failing to do enough to combat global warming. Lucy Maxwell is the co-director of the Climate Litigation Network and says this is an important test case.
The court has found that the Swiss government's weak climate action is a violation of its human rights obligations. And specifically, the court pointed to the Swiss government's failure to set a national carbon budget and to comply with its own climate targets. So that's a clear message to the Swiss government that what it needs to do is do its homework on climate change.
The court has jurisdiction over 46 countries in Europe, including the UK. Lucy Maxwell says it could have major implications for a number of active cases across Europe and future cases around the world.
The court's ruling in the Swiss case is of huge significance because it affirms that the European Convention on Human Rights applies to the climate crisis, that governments have legal duties to act, and they've upheld the right of people to go to court and challenge their government's weak climate action. So I think this is a huge moment for all of those communities in the 100 cases or so around the world who are taking their governments to court.
Meanwhile, two other major global warming cases before the court were rejected on procedural grounds on the same day. The Swiss Federal Office of Justice says it will analyse the judgment and consider future measures. This is Isabella Higgins in London reporting for AM.
A commercial laundry set up to create jobs for people who've been shut out of mainstream employment has just opened its doors near Byron Bay on the New South Wales far north coast. It's a region with high rates of homelessness and higher than average jobless rates. The project cost $12 million and it's mostly funded by philanthropists. With more, here's our national work reporter, Bronwyn Herbert.
Amongst the hums of dryers and washing machines, former social worker Mel Sass has found herself an unlikely job.
How are you going with those towels, mate?
The 32-year-old moved from Bendigo to the Byron Shire for drug and alcohol rehabilitation.
When I was about 90 days into my recovery journey, and I had $50 left to my name and I really desperately needed a job, but I didn't really know what to do with myself. Like I'd come from a background in a social worker and mental health and local government and the child protection space. And I knew that I wasn't well enough to go back into that sector. I knew that I was too fragile.
She's now one of 60 workers at a commercial laundry set up to prioritise jobs for people who face barriers to work.
I didn't need to provide a resume. I didn't need to give my life story. I didn't need to, you know, provide references. It was just as simple as, hey, I'm Mel. I don't really need to work.
56-year-old John Hardesty lives in a temporary pod village at Mullumbimby after he became homeless from flooding in 2022. He now works as a laundry assistant.
It means that I can actually afford to pay for my own accommodation. I can get my health issues in check. I've been able to reconnect with people again and function in life because I've been able to find this job and a lot of friends here.
It's taken Beacon Laundry founder Luke Terry almost 2 years to raise $12 million to get the laundry operational.
We're trying to find businesses that are good businesses anyway, but can double as something that can make incredible impact at the same time. For people with disabilities, for people with a lived experience of mental illness, for people that are experiencing homelessness, we believe that these businesses can create opportunities for everyone that wants the opportunity to work.
For Mel Sass, it's been a life-changing move.
It's given me confidence. It's given me structure and routine that really aligns with what I'm trying to do in terms of my recovery. So the income's great, don't get me wrong, but there's a lot of benefits for me in working here.
Laundry worker Mel Sass ending that report from Bronwyn Herbert. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Drugs, sex, and lavish dinners out. News organisations paying for interviews is hardly new, but the allegations about what Channel 7's Spotlight programme gave to Bruce Lehrman for a sit-down interview are surprising to say the least. Today, Media Watch host Paul Barry unpacks what's unfolded. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.